From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. What a tangled web Sue Miller weaves in her latest novel, Lost in the Forest. Just hours before the book opens, Eva is widowed. Her second husband, John, has died in a freak accident. Ex-husband, Mark, is called in for emergency duty, then wants to rekindle the old flame, or thinks he does. Teenage daughter Daisy spins into an affair with a much older man, and a very familiar, complex, contemporary American family finds itself deep in the woods of life. Since her big breakthrough novel, The Good Mother, more than 20 years ago, Sue Miller has been exploring family dynamics right down to their emotional core. What she exposes is not always pretty, always real, and often sexually charged. For Sue Miller's devoted readers, the emotional bond with her very human characters goes on long after the last pages are turned. Tonight on Point, Lost in the Forest, with best-selling novelist Sue Miller. You can join the conversation. Can you feel, do you know, firsthand, how fragile is the equilibrium of a family's life, of any life? And do you grab novels like Sue Miller's to read what isn't said, what isn't admitted in all of our lives? Join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is writer and novelist Sue Miller, author of a long list of provocative, tuned-in bestsellers, including The Good Mother, The World Below, and Family Pictures. Her new novel is Lost in the Forest. Sue Miller, it's good to have you back.
I'm delighted to be back.
Wow.
Thanks.
And here you are doing your thing again.
That's what everyone says, yeah.
Well, and I don't mean it in a repetitive way. You've always got a new twist of fate for people, and always that big bushel basket of insights and kind of naughty, illicit little things, the things that we think are we're privately saying to ourselves, somehow you've got a periscope in there. I'm just looking here in the first pages of this book, and right away you start pointing out those things, that the kind of thing that we all think one thing or another, but don't say, because it's just unseemly. It's forbidden. It's just a little bit off. I'm looking here, and of course, in the book, the second husband of Eva, John, I'm giving nothing away to say that, hours, minutes before the book opens, he's been killed in, in an automobile accident.
That's no withheld surprise.
No withheld surprise. And his two daughters and which he stepdaughters, I guess, from Eva's first marriage with Mark, and his son, young Theo, are dealing with this. Mark is drawn in. And right away, while they're dealing with this tragedy, you've got people thinking, well, here's Mark looking at his daughter, Daisy, whose sexuality and attractiveness becomes quickly a big deal. And he's thinking to himself, what a sad thing it is for a woman to be plain.
Mm-hmm.
Something we don't say. He looks at Mark, Theo, the boy who's not his genetically in any way. He's lighter skinned, lighter haired than the girls, his dark daughters. You think that's somehow sad, just that he's lighter haired. And then it gets into the really odd territory. He pictures the second husband, John, lying dead or dying in his ex-wife Eva's arms, and for a moment, he wishes, he imagines that it were him, him in her arms, dying, just to have that tenderness from her. Where do you get this stuff? Do you carry around a naughty thoughts notebook and jot it all down?
Well, these don't seem so naughty to me.
Not naughty, but we don't talk about them.
But I think often in books which sort of stay very close to someone's thoughts, there is this this willingness to look at information like this, at the way the mind works, the sort of thought that perhaps doesn't quite rise to full consciousness, that if someone asked Mark, what are you thinking, he would never articulate, because it's sort of there in a kind of just a passing thought, really. And I think that's what these are. I mean, I don't think they're things he would defend or argue for. They're just
not obsessing on them. They're just passing.
Yeah. And I think that is the way we often think. We often think terrible things about other people, people we like very well or even love, I think. And it's sort of one of the ways of getting at a character, I guess, is to reveal the sort of the things that he or she thinks when they're sort of unguardedly thinking to themselves, as we all do think to ourselves. but in that unmonitored way, I think. It seems to me that it's a lot of writing does present a sort of monitored version of what people are thinking. Mm-hmm. But I'm interested in the other, I guess, sort of bubbles up a little bit.
And that seems to me to be the magic of what you do. How do you catch those dark butterflies? How do you imagine them? How do you bring them back and pin them to the page for us?
I think it's just a matter of really imagining being the person and what the sort of deepest part of that person is. And that's part of the pleasure of writing fiction, it seems to me, is sort of entering imaginatively another person and imagining the other person as sort of fully and with as much complexity and with as much darkness and then, of course, as much pleasure in life as they are capable of having, too.
Here's a book, Your New One, Lost in the Forest, where you take a family and you put it under a great stress test and watch the kind of centrifugal forces that pull it apart, watch the way the chemistry of that trauma works on each of the individuals. What's your sequence? Do you lay out the plot first and then imagine all the emotional facets, angles, nuances off the plot?
Well, I think the sequence, the sort of way I've done things has been different with almost every book. And this book started with a short story about Mark and Eva and the accident. And sort of told the tale of Mark's yearning to get Eva back after her second husband dies, mm-hmm. and ends at a moment when he understands that's not going to happen, a moment that is also in this book when Theo suddenly speaks of his father and for the first time, really, and he sees in Eva's response how much she still is in love with her second husband, which is something he hasn't really come to terms with in some way.
Second husband is dead, but Mark sees, I'm not inside the magic circle here.
Yeah. But he also, I think, doesn't really seriously believe that Eva really ever could have loved him as much as she loved him. Mark doesn't believe that Eva loved John as much mm-hmm. as she loved him. He's always sort of held this magical notion in a certain way that I think a lot of us do. I mean, and
with first loves, first spouses,
yes,
that there's something eternal there.
Yes, you've got to be able to get this person back. And he really thinks he's going to be able to manage it no matter what, and he doesn't. So that was a kind of germ of it. Then I had this sort of notion of kids since my kid is now in his 30s, and I've been sort of running into people whose kids are now sort of grown up and doing what they're actually doing in life. Mm-hmm. And I knew these kids when they were being very traumatized by parents' divorces and sort of my generation's sort of wacky behavior. Mm-hmm. I include myself in this, I want you to know.
We sort of guessed that with the intimacy of your insights here.
And the notion of sort of following through someone until they're, in their 30s, essentially, was of interest to me. And I sort of looked at this story that I'd had sitting around for a long time, never published, and thought, well, I like those people. And there are these two daughters who must, who really have been traumatized by these two things. First of all, their parents are divorced. Mm-hmm. Second of all, their stepfather dies.
A beloved stepfather,
yes,
in this case. In many ways, a stronger shoulder to lean on than their biological father,
yes,
who they must now turn to.
Especially for Daisy, mm-hmm. he was, John.
The younger of the two teenage sisters.
Mm-hmm. So I thought I would sort of trace them through in some way, watch what happens to them after this, and somehow come to their sort of quasi-maturity. And then it made me think of the novel What Maisie Knew by Henry James, which is a wonderful one of his short novels. And it's about a little girl whose parents are sort of fortune hunters. They divorce each other. And because they're looking to marry somebody else, they have all these liaisons, they have these affairs, they behave very badly. And Maisie gets exposed to all kinds of really unpleasant and unscrupulous and really it's not good for her to be.
And she's watching.
Yeah. And the whole question for James is, what she's conscious of at what time. What Maisie Knew is the mm-hmm. title. And mm-hmm. and in a way, I thought, how interesting to take that and transpose it to late 20th century life, where the parents are, conscientiously and in a post-Freudian way trying to do parenting, which is called that weird gerund
right,
in this book.
Right, in this active way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And still end up leaving their daughter exposed because their lives are so disordered at the moment and their concerns are so primary to themselves at the moment that they leave this, my Daisy, as in a parallel to Maisie. sort of vulnerable by their inattentiveness.
And very literally exposed here, sexually exposed with a much older man, the husband of Eva.
A friend of the family.
Yes, really, a friend of the family, and not just in a passing way. I mean, she really spins off into quite a big, erotic, however misguided, affair.
Yes, no, she's very much a participant, however misguided, as you say, she is. It's something that is important for Daisy and that she seizes on in a certain way.
You know, you don't necessarily make your characters, they're endlessly fascinating, they're not necessarily likable, and you don't even necessarily bring them to a resolution that's at all easy. I guess that's the way life is.
Mm-hmm. I would think so. It's been my experience of life. Nothing is ever resolved.
Mine too. But I mean, you were saying earlier, I mean, it seems of a piece almost with those unspoken, unspeakable thoughts in the margins of our minds, mm-hmm. as representative of the way you're not filtering. You're not trying to bring symmetry here.
Well, I do hope that the book finally is a satisfying experience, mm-hmm. and a kind of complete experience, and has some, I suppose, some sort of symmetry in that way, but not in terms of sort of a balance of good and evil, or even a triumph of good over evil, but rather that it's aesthetically pleasing, finally, the book.
We're going to look at how these characters live, survive, thrive, find themselves, don't find themselves in Sue Miller's hands. We're talking tonight with best-selling novelist Sue Miller about the love, tragedy, sex, and family disarray in her new novel, Lost in the Forest. You can join us tonight. Can you feel, do you know firsthand how fragile is the equilibrium of any family, any life? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with best-selling novelist Sue Miller. Her new novel is Lost in the Forest. You may know one or many of her earlier novels, among them The Good Mother, The World Below, While I Was Gone, Family Pictures. Lost in the Forest, the new novel, and a family is put under extreme, a complex family, a typical American family in many ways in that regard. It's put under extreme pressure right from the get-go. Questions for you. Have you felt your family life unhinged by tragedy, by divorce, by infidelity? And how did you survive? How were you changed? And this, maybe, do you read novels to find the unspeakable made explicit, to read what can't be or just isn't said? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Sue Miller, right at the get-go, Eva's second husband, John, is right in front of the family, hit by a car and dies. You write later of her dealing after some time with her grief. I wonder if you can read a bit of that for us.
Yeah, I'm happy to. It wasn't until months later that Eva could bear to think of it as a process, her grief. When people suggested it to her in the days and weeks after John's death, new agey people, sloppy people, hateful people, she thought, she was sometimes speechless in her sense of affront at the notion, as though they had unexpectedly slapped her. She couldn't think of this roil of pain that swept in and out of her life as having either a predictable shape or an end point. It seemed to her a monster she'd bedded, one she'd come to love in some way. When it was gone, when it decided on some days, whimsically it seemed to her, not to be there, not to torment her. Then she was tormented by that, by its very absence. Sometimes in those early days of October and November, she felt amazed that life could happen around it, the things of life, the things that had always meant life. The children woke, and their waking woke her, their voices downstairs in the house, their bare feet thudding on the old wood floors. She got up, she urinated, and felt the familiar physical sense of pleasurable relief at that, her body's work, that it should work, that she should go on feeling anything because of that seemed preposterous to her. She brushed her teeth, she made the children's breakfast, and got them launched into their day. She went to the bookstore she owned, though the two women who worked for her often sent her home those first weeks after John died, if it wasn't a busy day in the office. She came home. She went to see Daisy play basketball, to see Emily cheerleading at a football game. She bought groceries. She picked up Theo at daycare. She made dinner. But anywhere in all of this, the monster could arrive and literally take her breath away. Sometimes she felt so overwhelmed when it happened that she squatted or knelt where she was. Once Daisy had found her in the kitchen, crouched on the floor, holding a partly peeled carrot in her hand. "What, Mom?" she cried. She'd stopped in the doorway, confused and frightened. "What happened?" And with that it was gone, as though Daisy had broken a spell cast upon her. Eva felt only embarrassed. She stood up and found the scraper she'd set down so hurriedly. "It's nothing," she said, turning her back to Daisy. And because that was so blatantly a lie, she added, "I just felt a little dizzy." Another time she sat weeping through an entire parent conference at Theo's daycare center. The woman talking with her was so young, so unfamiliar with the possibility of this scale of grief, that she took Eva at her word when she said, "It was all right, really. It sometimes just happened. Please ignore it if you can." She went carefully and thoroughly through her notes, tidy writing in black ink on 5x8 cards, while tears and clear mucus streamed steadily down Eva's face. When she'd finished, the teacher looked quickly and with some embarrassment over at Eva and asked if she had any questions. "No," Eva whispered. "None."
Sue Miller, reading from her new novel, Lost in the Forest. That line just stopped me cold and really made me think. You writing of her, seeing her grief as a monster she had bedded, one she'd come to love in some way.
Mm-hmm. And she speaks a little bit later on, or she thinks a little bit later on in this passage, that grief is like love, and that you are new love. You're consumed mm-hmm. by it, and in neither case do you want to let go of it, really, because when you let go of your grief, you let go of your connection to the person, so that she feels affronted by and sad when she doesn't have a terrible day in a certain way. She thinks of it as this monster, or later she calls it a familiar, you know, that she feels some pleasure in it in a certain way because it marks this
grief,
this last connection.
A monster she had bedded. I mean, that drama has that weird appeal. Her first husband, Mark, feels it as well. We mentioned it earlier, but he's imagining the scene where she's holding her dead husband, and you say feels this intense interest in the scene, even a yearning for it, for the drama of it, for Eva's panicked love.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, I mean, on the one hand, she can't deal with the sort of systems of life that want to talk about grief as a process.
Mm-hmm.
It's this blazing thing that there's the disconnect there. But they reconnect around that grief, and he's drawn to it. But what about her? Take us beyond the monster of the grief as she begins to look out at new life, to look back to her first husband. How did you put yourself behind her eyes, looking out at the world? What's the interior thought there?
She was very alone at this. She is very alone at this point, and I think feeling very overwhelmed by her children in some ways,
because they're needy, because they're desperate, and she's in her own.
That's right,
and desperation,
and especially she's worried about Theo, and she's worried about Daisy. Emily is sort of doing okay. She was very sorrowful, but she's going to go off to college, and she's better than the others. And she begins to sort of lean on Mark, and Mark willingly steps forward. And I think it doesn't occur to her for a while. And then she sort of starts thinking, well, maybe she could in some way take up with him again. These are sort of thoughts again. They're not fully articulated even to her, but she's drawn to it. She's sort of interested in it as he approaches her. She's interested when he holds her, which he does several times. She has a sort of responsiveness to the familiarity of that and the comfort and the ease of it. And there are some moments when she really thinks perhaps there could be some sort of partial, you know, coming together again. Mark is very interested in
women.
There's that too. He has been very interested in women. And Eva recognizes this, and I think fundamentally in some way. I mean, she says at one point, that way lies pain. You know, she's not really going to do it again. Mark would do it again. He would happily do it again. And he believes it's his sort of second chance. He believes it's going to be the thing in his life that's going to make him happy.
Mm.
So they're functioning, they're sort of off, but they're both working on it a little bit together. There's this tentative rapprochement, which means something quite different to each of them.
But it's a rapprochement. It's a moment in which I think even people who haven't been through this kind of trauma, I'm guessing, have fantasized about. Someone dies. What would I do in that case? So what spouse hasn't thought, oh, if I were alone, where would I turn?
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got this amazing moment going all the way back to the breakup of their first marriage when they're young, they don't have a lot of money, things aren't easy. She's sort of distracted with the kids. He goes off, has a fling, maybe as much as an affair with a bartender. When things aren't good, things get better. And on a quiet, peaceful night, he tells her what he did. And at that moment, he loses that first marriage.
Yeah. There's some need on his part to sort of pull her into it, to have her consent to it, to have her be, as he sort of thinks it or doesn't quite think right. it to himself, but to love even the part of him that had betrayed her.
Is that strength or weakness, oh mighty author?
I don't know. It's Mark.
It's human.
Yeah. And he recognizes instantly by her response yeah. that he's just blown it. I mean, as soon as he says it virtually, he knows that it's not. Well, she says it's over, and that is it for Eva. She's a very, as opposed to Mark, she's a very clear and absolute person, and he just sort of rolls with things, and he's not, he hasn't been very bright with Eva, I think.
Sumila, there are a lot of callers who want to join us, but I don't want to turn there until we get to Daisy. I mean, there's a lot going on in here, but the Daisy character is where things get, they get off the conventional mm-hmm. script. She's 15 or 16, and she's
15. 15. She's 14 and then 15 yes. And she's very, very angry about her stepfather's death because she's relied on him so much. I mean, her mother is very busy with this younger child, and her dad is busy with women in his life, and John has just been there for her. And she even suspects maybe later in her life that they made a conscious choice that he should take Daisy on because she's such a sort of loser of a kid. She's almost 6 feet tall at the age of 14. She slouches. She's shy. Her older sister's very popular, and Daisy just has nothing going for her except she's a sensitive, bright kid, but she's sort of antisocial.
But she's the trap door in this book, and I come to kind of expect it in a Sue Miller novel where things really veer off the map into forbidden territory. Mm-hmm. She ends up very much in the arms of a kind of Svengali-ish older guy. Lots of things could happen with a 15-year-old girl in a family that experiences a trauma. Why this one, Sue?
Well, I think to me, in a way, Daisy and Mark are the two main characters in this mm-hmm. book. And so what I want, I see them, but I mean, Eva is lost in the forest too with her grief, but that's actually in some ways a simpler and clearer
yes.
thing. Mark and Daisy are both lost in their own ways. And I wanted what happened with Daisy and to Daisy to have an impact on Mark. And it does indeed. And it changes Mark. I mean, I saw this novel in a certain way as those sociograms we used to have to draw in psychology, where you make a circle, you put the relevant people around yeah. in the edge of the circle. Someone acts, and you draw a line across the circle to the person who reacts.
Mm-hmm.
The reaction makes a line go across to someone else.
The ricochet goes on.
And you just watch these ricocheting lines of action and reaction. In this case, Daisy's reaction to John's death and to seeing that her original parents are sort of getting interested in each other again.
They're nuzzling a little bit.
Makes her even more angry, mm-hmm. is to sort of be floating out. She starts stealing money from her mother, and then this man, Duncan, having discovered that, he sort of uses that as a wedge to enter her life. And she willingly goes along. But there's some question she absolutely willingly goes along. But there is a question sort of raised later in the book about how much of all of this was or was not a conscious effort to get her father engaged with her in some way.
I've got to ask you on this point, because here you're really exercising your kind of empathic imagination, or maybe more direct. But you've got very explicit erotic scenes in this book between the 15-year-old and the, I don't know what, 40-year-old.
No, he's over 50.
Okay, over 50.
He's really an old guy.
Forgive me. He's ancient. Scenes so explicit. That in the hands of with this kind of this is the classic thing that's not supposed to happen, or that men are supposed to imagine would happen.
Mm-hmm.
In the hands of a male author, people would read and say, "Oh my, you got to be kidding me! You really think that a 15-year-old is going to feel this way? Yada yada, can't believe this. This is just a 50-something fantasy played out." But here you are writing it very intimately, very explicitly. And clearly not constrained in the way you do it. Why should you be? Describe that act of imagination for us. Do you go back to 15-year-old Sue Miller and project forward again? I mean, is this the, you come from a kind of a family of preachers on one side. Your own father, a professor of theology, we talked about in your last book. Is this the preacher's daughter cutting loose and letting her imagination float forward?
I don't think that has much to do with
it.
But I think, yeah, some of it surely is imagining sort of myself at that age and perhaps in that situation. But I think that for me, the imagining of that scene was to, imagining a reader reading that scene was to try to do two things at the same time. To me, it's sort of an appalling scene, and I wanted the reader to be appalled and at the same time to feel the kind of erotic interest Daisy has in it, that it's that she's someone that he's paying attention to her for one thing, and he's very subtle in the way there's a lot of dialogue in the scene.
A little blackmail, a little seduction.
And he's very persuasive. He's sort of slow, and lets her, you know, sort of asks her to sort of take the lead several times, and then is very reassuring when she won't, that sort of thing. And I think I wanted the reader to be on this in this uncomfortable place in that chapter, where it isn't written as though it's a sexual fantasy. If it were written as though it were a sexual fantasy, male or female, purely, I don't think there'd be any discomfort. I mean, it would just go.
The complexity would be gone, right?
Yeah, it's written as an observer, I think, and then as a, you know, on Daisy's shoulder, but I think with very much still that sense of me as a writer who is not Daisy, too.
You've been out talking with readers. How do your women readers respond to that scene? Do they say,
differently, one from another.
I had one. What's the range?
One woman told me it was pornographic, and this was after she'd asked me to sign the book. So I didn't get
Well,
that.
Pornographers sign books, too.
And then, you know, there have been women who said, you know, it turned me on, and I was intensely uncomfortable because of that.
Didn't want to be.
Yeah, because it just seemed so wrong. And then I've had women who said it turned me on, and that was fine with me.
So there's the range, all right.
Yes.
Well, Sue Miller always gets right in there where it's visceral. I want to begin to turn to our callers. George is calling from Milwaukee. Hi, George. You're on the air.
Hi, Sue. How are you?
I'm good.
I'm going to ask you two really brief questions. The first one will be easy. The second you might be a little bit uncomfortable with. The first is, Do you owe your stream of consciousness narrative to any specific author like James Joyce? The second question is, have you read a book by John Gardner called Moral Fiction? And if so, do you believe that part of your job as a novelist is to chart a moral path for your reader and to offer examples of virtue that might help change the world? Thank you.
Ooh, great questions, George. Thanks for calling.
The first is a question. I think I don't work in a Joycean way, although I probably owe a great debt to Joyce, the kind of minute observation that he did and the pleasure in daily life and just the moments of life, feeling a bit peckish. I think that those things obviously were a gift to me as they were to everyone else. And I think changed the way we write fiction and probably made it possible for me to write as I do, although I think I also write very differently. No one would accuse me of being Joycean, I don't think.
And an obligation to chart a moral course.
Yeah, Gardner, I have read Gardner, and I don't agree with him in that way. I think there is a kind of morality to fiction, actually. I mean, it seems to me that there's a kind of belief in people that, I mean, you simply wouldn't be writing it if you didn't believe there was something to be gained by entering another human being's experience. And it seems to me that that is in itself a moral statement. So in that way, I think everything I do is sort of as a writer, is imbued with morality, because what I'm actually really interested in doing is making you believe in these characters.
But that's kind of a minimalist moral statement, isn't it? I mean, that's not constructing a great...
Yeah, I mean, Gardner really did articulate this very clearly, that, and made distinctions among kinds of literature. Mm-hmm. There was literature which presented a moral good for people to read, and there was literature which didn't do this.
So beyond your empathetic rendering, your detailed rendering, do you see that larger obligation?
I don't think any writer should be obligated to anything. I am interested in it, however. I see that as being some of what I'm doing, but I don't see it as an obligation necessarily for others.
Sue Miller is with us tonight. Sorry, Sue, we're just coming to the breaker. Her new novel is Lost in the Forest. You can join us. Do you read novels to find the unspeakable made explicit? And in this novel, Mark loses his marriage when he confesses his infidelity to Eva. What's the bigger mistake, infidelity or confession? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with best-selling novelist Sue Miller about the love, the tragedy, the sex, and family disarray in her new novel, Lost in the Forest. You can join us tonight. Are you a Sue Miller devotee? What keeps you coming back? And are we all searching for a sense of self beyond our public persona? Do you see that going on in Sue Miller's novels? We'll touch on that. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. Talk. Emily's calling from Greensboro, North Carolina. Emily, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
I just had a comment, really. You were asking if we look to literature, really, to identify some emotions that are present in ourselves. And
yes.
My current situation, I have a family member who has been suicidal for some time, and one of the thoughts that goes through my head is, well, if this person did commit suicide, I would stand to gain a lot of money that could then pay for my graduate school. And there's a very negative stigma associated with thoughts like that. And I think because we do look to literature to reflect ourselves and to understand ourselves, that we can recognize that thoughts like that are okay and that they're human.
And Sue Miller takes us off into those shadows, and you can identify with what she's doing there, Emily.
Definitely. I find it reassuring, because if you say those things to people on the street or even your friends, you know, you're going to get a strange reaction sometime. But I imagine all of us thought.
It's taboo. Sue Miller, Emily's got a family crisis going on, a suicidal family member, and she says, thank you for reminding me that I'm not the only one thinking things
like
this.
Yeah, no, I think in the face of, you know, those kinds of catastrophes, there's a whole range of responses that all of us has, you know, every one of us has.
And within the space of 60 seconds very often, a wide range.
And we still can behave very responsibly and very well while we're, you know, wishing someone dead, actually. I know it very well.
Yeah. Emily, thanks for sharing that. Good luck with your family. Thanks for calling us. Sue Miller, Michiko Kakutani reads this book, and she makes an interesting point in the New York Times review there. She says that you suggest that people have a primal need to discover a sense of self separate from the personas they wear in public life, and separate, too, from the roles they are used to assuming within their families. And you suggest, she says, that romantic passion often provides a catalyst for discovering that alternate private self. Are you about that in some part? Is that what you're telling us? Everyone's looking out to find that internal personal definition of themselves is not the mask they put up to the world at large, or even to their family?
Well, I'm interested in sort of how people become who they are, and I, you know, even adults, how they change, what makes people able to change. I mean, and that's why for me in this book, Mark and Daisy are the two sort of central figures, because they do change, and they change, they allow themselves to be changed. I think she's talking mostly about Daisy in terms of that, because Daisy is really struggling somehow to find herself, and is, you know, in the act of making herself or trying to, and thinking about alternative ways she can be. There's one point at which she helps her in her mother's bookstore when there's a sort of self-help author who's coming through to do a reading or actually a talk. And she's, you know, really speculating on what makes someone happy and how am I going to get to be happy, and thinking.
She's actively working on the scenario.
Yeah, and I think, and her connection with Duncan is, I think, part of that, too. I mean, it's
the
one possibility.
Mm-hmm.
It's triggered, in effect. She's playing a game of charades, in fact, at one point when Duncan becomes titillated by her, mm-hmm. part of the, mm-hmm. his titillation. Part
she
of
comes
it
out
is,
as the dominatrix.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and she's wearing, you know, boots and an old bathing. She's wearing sort of dress-ups.
And suddenly she's not a kid. She's
yeah,
a young woman.
Yeah, everyone at the party has a different reaction, and her mother is just appalled and very furious at the other people, the other grown-ups, which she expresses once Daisy's out of hearing. Mm. But Daisy is delighted by this alternate possibility. And I think when we are sort of struggling with the notion of who we could be and not liking who we think we're going to get to be, the ability to put on another persona and to experiment with it is wonderful. And in a way, that's what Daisy is doing in a lot of this, mm-hmm. I think.
You have this interesting kind of flashing forward. Even as she's experiencing, let's say, her seduction, suddenly we're hearing years in the future the voice of her psychotherapist and how she's speaking to him about it. Of course, so the psychotherapist becomes a current narrator of history before it's history.
Yeah.
Give us a hint as to how she ends up looking back on this very unusual experience.
Well, she looks in a complicated way. I mean, mm-hmm. she knows she should look back on it as something terrible which happened to her. And in a certain way, her therapist agrees with that. I mean, at one point she speaks of her affair, and she mm-hmm. said, I would call it his affair with you.
Right.
And her therapist suggests she read Lolita because she thinks it might help her. But
Humbert brought to life. Yeah.
But Daisy does not see it that way. Mm-hmm. And because I think she comes to see how it's part of her whole life and how she, in fact, how it changed her life, how she used it in a certain way, too. Mm-hmm. She sees herself as a little more in control. Not in control, I don't think, as an adult, but as being... as sort of using it, as active, that's mm-hmm. it, I think.
It was grist for her becoming.
For her transformation, mm-hmm. yeah, exactly.
The title of the book, Lost in the Forest, as I read it, comes from a game that the family at one point plays or had played around the kitchen table, where someone starts off a line or two in a story, and they just go around the table, mm-hmm. each person.
A fairy tale.
Adding a line to a fairy tale. That's a game I know well. I love this game. I've played it in lots of circumstances, but it made me think about what you do, the way you see the world, because, of course, we can each start that tale, but others are contributing, whether it's in our family, in our lives, and we don't have any control over the cast they put on the story, the mm-hmm. spin they give to the narrative. I just wonder about that as a metaphor for the work you do, for the way you see life.
Well, I think there is that sort of each member takes over the story, but each member probably also is part of the story. I mean, in the larger metaphoric mm-hmm. sense, is part of the story of each of the other members' lives. But I think also, you know, obviously I meant it for a metaphor for all of us, that there is this sort of, and I think, you know, I was thinking too, not just of fairy tales, but also of Shakespeare, the sort of sense in which he often sends his characters off into a forest for a while, and there are all these transformations and misalliances and strange things which happen, and then at the end they emerge and live happily ever after. But I, you know, I do think that it sort of stands in a way for the way I think we go through life, lost most of the time, and we have these moments of salvation where we see things clearly and then perhaps subside again into some other crisis. I mean, we move in that way in life, I think. We end this book at a moment when Daisy feels she's really risen and emerged from all of this successfully. But I think there's a scene when they tell this story earlier on in the book, the Mark actually ends the story, and he says, and they all lived happily ever after. And Eva's heart is breaking as he says this, because she knows this isn't true. And, you know, Theo is clapping and saying, the end.
The three-year-old and doesn't know.
Yeah, and Eva is thinking, oh, God, you know, I'm so glad we made it through that moment, because it was awful. Because she's feeling how impossible it is to live happily ever after. She's feeling the weight of her grief. It's the end of that day,
that
she's thinking of mm-hmm. grief so much. So for me, it's very complicated, but I do think it sort of serves as a sort of metaphor for the way most of us proceed through life, lost and found and lost and found.
And things get pitched in, and we deal with them. Sometimes they fit our frame, sometimes they don't. Mm-hmm. So, Miller, it's a wonderful book, and we thank you for all the insights, for the diary you must have kept to bring all the psychological insights to bear. And thanks for being with us tonight. Great to have you.
Oh, it was really my pleasure. Thanks.
Novelist Sue Miller, her new novel is Lost in the Forest. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, Star Trek reaches its final frontier. This is On Point. After 10 movies and 5 television series, the Star Trek franchise may have reached its final frontier. Tomorrow night will be the final episode of Star Trek Enterprise, marking the end of nearly a 2-decade run for the Star Trek crews since The Next Generation debuted in 1987. With its 4-year stint coming to a close, Enterprise is boldly going where no Star Trek series since the original has gone, to the graveyard of canceled programs. Robert Thompson is director of the Center for the Study of Popular Television at Syracuse University. Earlier, I asked him how he's interpreting the demise of Star Trek after all these years.
The big question is not why is Star Trek experiencing its demise now? The big question is, isn't it incredible how long this franchise has managed to keep on going and going pretty strong as well? I mean, back when the first Star Trek television show played, we were in the throes of a space race, an exciting Apollo project. We were on our way to the moon. It really made sense because the conquest of space was one of the central adventure myths of America at the time. The Star Trek franchise has managed to, in fact, transcend all of the changes in culture as our interests went from outer space to inner space to cyberspace to biotechnology and cloning and all of the rest of it. The Star Trek franchise kept on moving along. And what's even more interesting is that the very first Star Trek plays, doesn't do all that well on network television, gets canceled, and the whole explosion of this kind of Star Trek universe essentially happens with people who are watching that old show in reruns. Many of the Trekkies, in fact, cut their teeth, not on original episodes, but on the rerun episodes. And that cultural energy would eventually come to the movies and then all of this long line of series.
Just a part of the American vocabulary, everything from their phrases to their weapons to their relationships, known by millions and millions. Bob, at its most robust, what was the bright heart of this show, of its idea, its conceit?
There's one thing that this show was always true to. Actually, two things. And the first thing was that it created a universe with rational rules that it obeyed. People loved the fact that there was a Klingon language, that there were the ways certain technologies worked, and they were consistent across it. You can create an unbelievably outrageous universe if you're consistent with what the rules are. Number two, and again this goes back to the very beginning, Star Trek was really never about space or aliens or any of that. It was really about the daily important issues that are going on here on planet Earth in the 20th and 21st century. Star Trek was one of the only shows back in the 1960s that were dealing in entertainment TV with issues like race and imperialism and all those things that we were hearing about like crazy on the news, but that were ignored entirely by the primetime entertainment. Star Trek could do it because of this conceit, this disguise, that it was all happening on another planet and another solar system and all of the rest of it. So I think in the end, Star Trek was really more a domestic issues drama that was just kind of disguised in outer space.
Michael Peck writes in the USA Today that he knows educated people who can quote more lines from Captain Kirk than from Hamlet. Why Trekkies, Bob Thompson? Why such intense loyalty, people dressing up, the desire almost to move into that realm of imagination and live there?
I think because it was one of the few shows that actually created a realm in enough dimensions that you actually felt like you could do it. I don't think anybody, even though it went for 10 seasons and everybody liked it and it was a number one show, you would never dream of having a Friends convention. Well, actually, some people do and probably have them, but it wouldn't have caught on. You wouldn't think of dressing like Ross and Rachel, because once you dressed like them, what would you do? You could make wisecracks and that kind of thing. The thing about the Star Trek universe is it really invited you into it. It was that you could watch the TV show, but then you could make the sequels yourself. You could put on the ears and have the costumes. And as much fun as those Trekkies got poked at them, and let's face it, they took a lot of ribbing, the most famous being Saturday Night Live, where William Shatner finally spoke at a convention and told them to get a life. And it was fun to do that. But you really have to admire those people who, before the internet, before you could gather these communities with ease, you know, in your own bedroom or office, that they got together to discuss a text. If people did that, regular people outside of universities, about Shakespeare or Whitman or Blake, we would really admire it. And I have to say, I was always kind of envious of people who were so into something that they could get so much pleasure as to dress up and meet together and all the rest.
But even at the fringes of trekkiness, even if you just stuck your toe in and didn't know all the text, you could feel a kind of idealism there, not just the dress-up party, but the sense of a better world that somehow flowed, at least in earlier renditions through Star Trek.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the things I think that made Star Trek so refreshing was that it was without irony or guile. I mean, there was a sense that this was really a show that dealt with these idealistic, utopian sorts of ideas. You know, idealism and utopian notions had really become kind of square by the time we got to the end of the century. And this show never kind of stepped away from this highly sincere approach to its subject matter.
But it did darken. I mean, in the 60s, when the world had this promise, the joy of exploration that was paralleling what we were seeing in NASA, in American ambitions. More recently, as it got darker, we saw their numbers drop from 12 million for Next Generation viewers to 6 million viewers in the first season of Enterprise, and then just 3 million in the fourth season.
Right, and it's hard to tell what exactly the variables were causing that. I mean, one could have been the darkening, the idea that people really wanted to see something that was lighter and more optimistic, though I think it would have seemed Pollyannish if Star Trek would have continued to take the attitude it took in the 60s.
Maybe America darkened too.
America absolutely did darken. So the question is, did people quit watching because of the change in tone that I think was actually a good decision on Star Trek's part? Or did it just get to the point that, you know, like you and I, when we get to a certain age, we do begin to wear out? Any storytelling venue wears out, and I think probably that's about where Star Trek is now. I would, however, say this. If I had to put my money on which has the better chance of success, another Star Trek franchise coming out in, let's say, 5 years after a period of detox, or whatever might happen with Star Wars, there's been some talk of doing a television show with that brand on it, I think I'd put my money on Star Trek. I think there is a very real possibility that this is a franchise that could rise again.
Well, in the meantime, through the miracle of reruns and cable, it will never exactly go away. For all the Trekkies out there who will miss it, our sympathies tonight. Bob Thompson, to you, I can only say, live long and prosper.
And you too.
Thanks, Bob.
Thank you.
Robert Thompson is director of the Center for the Study of Popular Television at Syracuse University. The last episode of Star Trek Enterprise will air tomorrow night on UPN. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Rachel Dornhelm, Eileen Amata, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Marika Buquays and Pam Ferdinand. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.